And it's my pleasure to deliver Cox the lectures here in the Fields Institute. And indeed, I'm staying here for 3 weeks, so just which makes this opportunity even nice. Well, as the title of my lecture indicates, I shall speak about 2D statistical hydrodynamics and about 2D turbulence. So let me just start with a few words about turbulence in dimension 2D and in dimension 3D. Actually, turbulence is one of the most exciting problems of exact sciences of our days because it is moved essentially unchanged through the whole 20th century, despite the most serious efforts of many of the best physicists of last century and quite a number of the best mathematicians of the century. And as usual, it is usual with the problems of this scale, the right statement of the problem is not clear, because usually right statement goes simultaneously with the right solution. But in the case of the theory of turbulence, and in the case of the problem of turbulence, it's even worse, because not only the right statement is clear, but also the right language which you have to pick up to find the right statement is not clear. And following G.I. Taylor and Andrei Nikolaevich Kolmogorov and their schools and their followers, majority of the involved people believe now that the right language for the theory of turbulence is the language of the theory of probability. And in this language, the mystery of turbulence is that the probabilistic characteristics of motion of fluid in the turbulent regime are rather universal and depend only on a few parameters which characterize the flow. And when we use the probabilistic language, then the theory of turbulence becomes a part of statistical hydrodynamics. And well, the problem of turbulence, of course, is immensely difficult. And one of the reasons for its difficulty is that 2D turbulence is something about motion of three-dimensional fluid, and the motion of three-dimensional fluid is described by three-dimensional Navier-Stokes system. And of course, this is a notoriously difficult partial differential equation, because I'm pretty sure that just everybody here knows that it is still unknown if the initial value problem for 3D Navier-Stokes system is well posed. And just, of course, everybody heard about this $1 million prize. And in difference with the three-dimensional case, which is the real physical case which deals with the reality which we live in, the motion of two-dimensional fluid is being described by the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. And Navier-Stokes equation, 2D Navier-Stokes equation, is a much nicer object because it is known that this is nice, and this is nice partial differential equations, and initial value problem for 2D Navier-Stokes equation is well posed. And in the theory of 2D turbulence, substantial progress was achieved in last years. And this progress is essentially to new results which were proven about nonlinear partial differential equations perturbed by a random force which were obtained in last 5 years. And essentially this result is the topic of my lectures. Well, there are some reasons to pick them up. First, because these results are new. Second, because these results are nice. Third, because they are related to really extremely important problem. And the fourth, which is a consequence of the three first parts, that in this group of questions there are really lot of open problems of different level of complexity. So I really strongly believe that this is a booming topic. So therefore, I just picked it up for my lectures. Okay, but first, before to start to speak about 2D turbulence and about 2D statistical hydrodynamics, let me tell a few words if the two-dimensional turbulence exists. First, try to find two-dimensional turbulence should be the following. Let us take two plates, and let us consider motion of fluid between these two plates. Then if the fluid moves with a low velocity, that indeed motion of this fluid is two-dimensional, and the vertical component of the velocity is not excited at all. So this is indeed a two-dimensional motion, and the motion of this fluid is described by the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. which is a good message because it, for example, tells us that the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation really has to do something with real hydrodynamics. But all this is so nice and so okay, so nice only if you consider motion of fluid which is not fast. So all these nice pictures happens with laminar motion of fluid. As soon as the velocity of the fluid becomes high, then the motion, so as soon as motion of fluid between these two plates become turbulent, then the motion immediately becomes three-dimensional, because immediately the vertical component of the velocity field is being excited. Yes, so in this way we cannot find two-dimensional turbulence, and this the most straightforward way give us no examples of a two-dimensional turbulence. Fortunately, there are some other examples which are much less obvious, and the most important example is the motion of the Earth's atmosphere, because the atmosphere of the Earth, of course, this is a two-dimensional object. Because the height of the atmosphere is something like 20 to 30 kilometers, and the length of the equator is 40,000 kilometers. So of course this is a two-dimensional object, and it is more or less clear, and it can be seen from pictures like this, which are taken from the web page of NASA, that indeed motions of atmosphere looks like something two-dimensional. This is one picture. Just for example, there is another one. There is another one, which is even better hopes that this is something two-dimensional. Okay, so no matter. Just experts believe that this is motion of atmosphere. This is two-dimensional motion, and this is for sure that it is described by Navier-Stokes equation, because Navier-Stokes equation very nicely described. Motion in the Earth if the corresponding velocities are subsonic, and then of course this is what we deal with. Of course, if you are outside extreme cases like Borus or something like this. Well, there are other more exotic physical examples which really give rise to two-dimensional turbulence, but maybe the most important, that the 2D turbulence is a good mathematical model for 3D turbulence. When we consider this model, then we can separate the difficulties which come from the fact that 3D Navier-Stokes equation is very difficult by itself. We can separate them from the difficulties which are difficulties due to the nature of the problem which we consider. So it seems to be right strategy first understand reasonably well what happens in two-dimensional turbulence, and then start to achieve something in the 3D for the 3D case. Okay, and the last what I wish to tell about in the introduction, these references which are relevant for me. First, there is a brilliant book of Batchelor, which is called The Theory of Homogeneous Turbulence. This is extremely well written book. I really like it a lot, and just for me this is the most important reference. Also, there is much more recent book of Uriel Frisch, Turbulence. There is my review paper, which is good, and advantage of this paper is that it is short, only 15 pages. This is a reference. And there is a famous book by Vishek Fursikov, Mathematical Problems in Statistical Hydrodynamics. And another remark, that this paper, as well as all my papers which I shall refer to, can be downloaded from my webpage, and my web pages can be easily found using Google. Okay. So now let us start with some general words about 2D hydrodynamics in finite volume. In finite volume means that I shall discuss 2D hydrodynamics which describes motion of two-dimensional fluid which occupies finite volume. So this is usual 2D Navier-Stokes equation. Here U is velocity of fluid, nu is kinematic viscosity, P is pressure, U tilde is force which we apply to the fluid, and we have this non-compressibility condition. And these are three unknown functions, two functions due to U and pressure, the third function, and we have three equations to find the three unknown functions. These are two equations, and this is the third equation. And two cases, either either space variable belongs to a bounded two-dimensional domain, which is smooth boundary, and on the smooth boundary, then we impose Dirichlet boundary condition, or we consider periodic case, and in this case, space variable belongs to two-dimensional torus, for example, to this one of size 2 pi. And in this case, I shall always assume, in addition, that the mean value of the force and the mean value of the velocity vanishes. This is not a serious restriction, just for technical reasons, it is better to assume it. And almost all the time in my talk, I shall consider periodic boundary condition, and I shall I shall all the time speak about periodic boundary condition, but the majority of the result which I shall speak about also apply in this Dirichlet case. In the Dirichlet case. Say it again, Walter. Yes, this is true. This is true. Okay, Walter. This is correct. So it means that I study equation one also with initial condition which have zero mean value. This is what does it mean? This is true. So yes, you're right. So this is just innocent restriction indeed. So okay. So let me introduce what will be for me the phase space for my problem. So H, this is just L2 space of vector field on torus, such that divergence of this vector field vanishes, and such that the mean value vanishes as well. Since these are vector fields of low smoothness, that we should make additional remark that the divergence apply in the sense of generalized function. But this is rather straightforward. And during my course, I shall view a vector field u of tx, which is unknown in equation one, either as a vector function of three variables, or also I shall often view u of tx as a curve u of t, which take value in the space h of function of x. And I shall switch between these two languages. So if I view u of tx as a curve in the space h, then this is a dynamical system approach, dynamical system language. If I view u as a function u of tx, this is just classical partial differential equation language. Okay, the next step is very classical. This is just eliminating of pressure. For technical reason, it is convenient for me to eliminate pressure from equation one and to view it as an equation on the vector field, on the velocity vector field u of tx only. And there is a classical way to do it. Let us consider usual Hopf decomposition on the torus. If you take any L2 vector field on torus, just any L2, then this vector field Vx can be in a unique way decomposed as a sum of constant vector field plus gradient vector field plus a vector field from the space H, which has zero divergence and zero mean value. Accordingly, we have a nicely and correctly well-defined linear operator P, which maps the whole space L2 to the space H. And in the specific case under consideration, when we apply this object to study Navier-Stokes equation, the operator P is called Lyrae projector. It's called Lyrae projector. Then now let us apply Lyrae projector to the equation one. Then what we have, it is also very, very well known, also very classical. So I apply projector P to my equation. Yes, then since divergence of U vanishes, then P of U equals to U. So I don't need P here. And so this is the result of application. And let us denote P minus P composed with Laplacian minus A. And let us denote P applied to nonlinear term and B. And let us write a Navier-Stokes equation in this form 1'. Let me just keep this equation on the blackboard, so I shall keep a couple of the most important equations here. So u dot plus, yes, plus nu times a of u plus b of u equals to e to of t, and this is the equation 1', which is used in this sort of a language of dynamical system, because here I shall, in this notation, I view u of t and a of t as a curve in the space H. And also I shall need a basis in the space H. And the best for me is the most straightforward L2 trigonometrical basis in the space H. This basis is formed by functions cosine S scalar product with X times vector S, which is orthogonal to S, times normalizing constant. And also by functions sine SX times vector orthogonal to S. And this function goes in pairs, so and we can enumerate them in such a way that these functions are ES and these functions are just E minus S, and in this case just simply the vector S runs through half of the set Z2. So this is more or less so just nothing happened here. So this is usual trigonometric basis for the space L2 of divergence free vector fields. Okay, so this was about 2D hydrodynamics. Now what is about 2D statistical hydrodynamics? To speak about statistical hydrodynamics, we have to somehow introduce randomness in the solutions of 2D Navier-Stokes equation. The most natural and the most straightforward way to do it is the following. Let us assume that the force which we apply to the equation equals to zero. Let us assume that the initial condition in the equation, which is the value of u evaluated at t equal to zero u naught fx, is a random element of the function space H. So this is a random field on the torus T2. So it means that the initial condition depends on the random parameter omega, and this random parameter omega belongs to some probability space omega with sigma algebra and with probability p, which is not that important for me and not actually. You will see that it is very, very seldom when this probability space will just appear in my lectures, and very often in books and the papers on the theory of statistical hydrodynamics and on the theory of statistical turbulence, this probability space, they are not mentioned. So something happened to the pointer, but it is not that important. Okay, and then let us assume that the initial condition is of order one, and then since I have no force in this my equation now, then it is easy to see that the solutions of my equation becomes decay as exponent of minus nu t. But for the cases which are important for the theory of turbulence, the kinematic viscosity nu is very small. So this rate of decaying is very low. And then, therefore, people are doing, they study solutions of equation while they are for the one. It means that they study solutions for equation when t is much smaller than just nu to the degree minus one. Then, since initial condition depends on the random parameter, then our solution also depends on the random parameter, and we can study random properties of this solution. This is the most natural, maybe the most natural way to approach the problem. This is the most straightforward way to find a mathematical language which will introduce randomness in the problem. And this language was used by many mathematicians. Maybe first who did it systematically was Eberhard Hopf. In his famous paper, then was Kiprian Foyesh, who did lot of good mathematics for this group of problems. Also Bishop Furosikam considered this problem in their book, and of course the whole theory of turbulence Kolmogorov at one, which is the first stage of Kolmogorov attempt to understand theory of turbulence, was inside this language. But this language and this approach to study statistics of turbulence has one very serious disadvantage. Namely, in this case, we consider decaying turbulence. And the fact that we consider decaying turbulence has both physical and mathematical disadvantage. Physical disadvantage is that usually in physics people consider stationary turbulence. So usually people consider motions of fluid which not decay with time and which stay of order one all the time. And also on mathematical side, it is substantially more difficult to study decaying processes than stationary processes. So despite this language and this approach is the most straightforward, it is not that good. It is not good. So, yeah.
that you can take that, without noise, go over the case of why don't we re-expand the solution by multiplying, say, by dilating by keys to new t, so that the solution stays where we want.
Yes, this is a good idea. Still, it's very difficult, Walter. Still, you're saying how to study decaying process, right? But still, decaying processes are difficult. So this is a way how to address this difficult problem. Yes, it is. But it's really very difficult. And it, okay. So what people achieve here? What people whom I refer to achieve? They just proved essentially existence theorem. So they never proved. Okay, they proved something which is. So first and very natural steps were done, and it turned out that it's extremely difficult to make second step and to get any result which could slightly surprise physicists. And in this another approach, we can obtain results which really surprise physicists, because I know from my experience that they really surprise them. So now about stationary turbulence. To address stationary turbulence, the right idea is to assume that our equation is being perturbed by the force eta of Tx, which is dependent on the random parameter omega. So it means that the force which we apply to our equation is a random field. And then if so then our solution also depends on the same random parameter. And in this way, despite from the first glance, the equation is more difficult because we have non-zero right-hand side. But it turns out that just in this way, indeed, we can study stationary processes related to the theory of turbulence, and in this way we can go substantially far. But first, but of course this is crucial to understand which kind of forces. Which kind of restrictions should we impose on the force eta of Tx, which is the right hand side of our equation. And these restrictions which are essential after Andrei Nikolaevich Kolmogorov. Here also this is Moscow folklore knowledge, because Kolmogorov never wrote in his papers what these restrictions for. But he gave it in many informal talks, and so just I know. And these restrictions for sure are due to Kolmogorov, because I know them from Vishek, and I'm a student of Vishek, and also from Sinai, who knows this from Kolmogorov himself. So what is the right classes of random forces which we should apply to Navier-Stokes equation to get right results? First, the force eta of Tx is a function of space variable x should be smooth. Secondly, as the function of time t, the force eta of Tx should be a random process which is stationary in t. So probabilistic characteristic of the force should not decay when time changes. Also, what is important here that if we compare eta of t with eta of t small plus t capital, where t capital is a positive parameter which is a time scale of our force, then these two random variables should be practically independent. For example, they can be just independent, or maybe their correlation can decay exponentially where we have negative exponents proportional to t capital. Yes, sure. Yes.
And n of t seems to be scaling like a on u. So it should be two derivatives worse than u. So why is it reasonable to assume eta of t is also in the same space?
No, it is not. It is not in the same space. It is not in the same space. Actually, you're right. So this is okay. So this is just space. This is okay. So in this whole business, so exact information about smoothness of solution is not at all relevant. So this is not about how smooth solutions are. Solutions and forces they will be much smoother than the space X. X is just some language, just some place to put objects there and then to study them. This is not at all optimal smoothness of forces and just not at all optimal smoothness of solutions. This is a special game. So in this game, we really use just a very few Sobolev spaces. So difficulty are not lying there. Difficulties are not lying in understanding how what is optimal smoothness of solution. They lie in some other place, and I hope to show this. So this is just language, so to say, just language. Okay. So still, since everybody belongs to the space H, then we can decompose our force eta evaluated at time t in the basis which I have in my space H. And that in this case, of course, I have decomposition has the form Fourier mode ES times Fourier coefficient number S. And let me write down Fourier coefficient number S in the following way. First comes factor BS. And BS is a scalar constant which measures the size of Fourier coefficient number S. Next comes factor eta S. And eta S is a random process, so this is a random function of t, which is a random process of order one. Yes? So Fourier coefficient number S is written down as product of two objects. First comprises size of Fourier coefficient number S, and second comprises random nature of Fourier coefficient number S. And since due to assumption one, since the force is smooth, then of course this scalar coefficient BS is a function of S should decay fast enough. Let us impose another extra assumption, one more assumption, which helps a lot. And this assumption is the following. Let us assume that the Fourier coefficient ES for different S's are independent. Well, this is nice assumptions, and physicists don't object, and this assumption helps a lot. So just once again, in this picture, so BS is the intensity of Fourier mode number S, and then in the most important case, BS is a function of S, decays faster than any negative degree of S. In this way, the force which apply to the equation, the function of S, is smooth, simply smooth. Now I shall give two examples of forces. So despite that I have this nice class of forces due to Kolmogorov, up to now we can treat only two special cases of forces, and which are not exactly from this class, but which are reasonably almost from this class. First, these are white noise forces. Okay, so let us consider the case when the Fourier coefficient, when this random component of Fourier coefficient ES is a time derivative of a standard Wiener process beta S. And let us assume that for different S's, we have here standard Wiener processes, so there are infinitely many of them, and these processes are independent. In this case, the right-hand side eta S, which I have in my equation, this is time derivative of another process, and this process is zeta, and this process zeta is the following. So now beta S is just a Wiener process. So eta is a function of time is a white noise process, and eta is a time derivative of process zeta, and zeta is a function of time is a Wiener process. So and this is what is called Wiener process in the functional space H. And this is just crazy picture of typical trajectory beta S. So beta S is just a Wiener trajectory. Okay, this is very popular example. Advantage of this example is that we can write quite a number of specific calculations, so we can calculate some numbers with this example. And just disadvantage of this example is that this is Gaussian force, so in this way we can study only Gaussian forces, and nobody told us that the right forces are Gaussian. And second example is free from this disadvantage. And this is what is called kick forces. So let us assume that the process ES as a function of t is a delta function supported by value of time proportional to t capital. Yes, and then here I have a delta function at zero, and in front of delta function I have a random coefficient zeta naught. Here I have a delta function which is supported by t small equal to t capital, and here comes another random coefficient, another delta function. So this is This is what is called kick force. Well, just this advantage of this example is that we can choose, if this random variables xi s here, they not at all should be Gaussian. We can choose here random variables of different statistics. Disadvantage is that this is even more exotic than the example above. Yes, because here as a function of t, our force is even more degenerate as before. And then I shall speak. Yes, and then of course this in the case of kick forces, our forces as a function of t are not stationary, but they're just periodic with period t. But this is also good. This is more or less about the same. So these are two classes of forces which we can consider. But of course, both this class of forces, this function of t, they're generalized. So generalized functions. So I have tell a few words how we define notion of solutions of Navier-Stokes equation in this case. Okay, so in both cases, in the case A and in the case B, eta of tx as a function of t is a generalized function because in the white force case, eta as a function of t is a time derivative of function zeta, which depends on a random parameter, but as a function of t, which is continuous. So eta is only time derivative of a continuous function. So we should explain how do we define solution in this case. Well, it's very natural. Just in this case, to get right definition of solution, we should just integrate equations one prime from zero to t. And then in this case, if we integrate equation 1 prime from 0 to t, then what we have in the right-hand side is just an increment of the function zeta of t, which is just increment of a continuous function. So in this case, we have that the function u of t, which depends on a random parameter, is a solution for this equation. If for every or for almost every choice of random parameter, this integral relation holds for any positive value of time t. And perfect reference just for this equation and for explain what happens here is the book of Wishek-Fursikov. And for example, it is proven there that this equation has a unique solution and some basic properties of this solution are studied. For example, well, just the solution is smoother than the force is, but this is not what I'm interested in my talk. And now, in the case of kick forces, situation is even nicer. So if I have kick forces, then I can write it down like this. So I can just rewrite my kick force in the following way, this which is written here. And then solution of Navier-Stokes equation subject the kick force should be understood in the following way. From time 0 to time t, I have a solution of free Navier-Stokes equation with no force at all. Then at time t capital, the first kick comes. First kick is a random kick, and it immediately changes position of my solution, and the change exactly equals to the first kick eta 1. Next, from time t capital to time twice t, again I have a solution of free Navier-Stokes equation. And then at time twice t, second kick comes. Then from 2t to 3t, I have again solution of free Navier-Stokes equation, and the third kick comes. This is, if so, then if I evaluate solution of my equation only at value of time proportional to t capital, then just obviously solution of my equation evaluated at time k times t capital can be obtained in the following way. I have to take my solution evaluated at time k minus 1 t capital, and I have to apply operator st, which is where the operator st is a time t shift along trajectories of three Navier-Stokes equation. And I have to add here kick number k. So this is a nice way to write down the dynamical system corresponding to kicked Navier-Stokes equation. Yes. And in the case of kicks, I shall study solutions of my equation only at values of time proportional to t capital. So if I shall speak about my Navier-Stokes equation where the force is a tick force, it means that I shall study my solution only at time 0, t, twice, t3, t4, t, etc. And in this case, the dynamic of my solution is described by this dynamical system. So in this case, I shall view Navier-Stokes equation as a discrete time dynamical system. Okay, so now just let me, yeah. But the fact, Walter, that the flow map ST is well defined. So if it happens that it is proven, then just for 3D Navier-Stokes equation, flow maps ST are even not that nice as in 2D case, but reasonably nice, then just most of our theory will apply there as well. So the main, but unfortunately we don't know this. This is true. Right, this is true. We can. But there will be no turbulence there. There will be statistical hydrodynamics without turbulence. But yes, but you're right. This can be done. But yes, but then just the main point is to study turbulence. Yeah. So all results below are proven for the case either forces which await in time or for the forces which are kicks in time. Certainly all of them generalize to the general forces which are forces a la Kolmogorov, and there were the three conditions 1, 3, 3. But this is absolutely non-trivial generalization. It was not done yet. But because it's a new problem, so this is one of open problems which you have here. And this is a good question just to prove what we can prove for ticks and for white forces for general classes of forces. Okay. So now I am coming to the main objects and to the main definitions related to my talk. And these are stationary solutions and stationary meshes. So I am speaking about equation 1 prime. And now it will be slightly easier for me just to introduce second phase space for my equation. I shall denote by H script the space of continuous divergence free vector field with zero mean value. So using this phase space, I shall be able to make my statement easier and just more transparent. Then comes the following basic definition, which I shall explain in some details just in a couple of minutes. So okay, so a curve U of t, which is a curve in the space H script, where t is positive or t belongs to the whole real line, is a stationary solution for equation 1 prime if the distribution of this solution evaluated at time t, which is a measure in the space H, is a measure which is independent of time. And then this measure, I shall denote it as mu, is called stationary measure for equation 1 prime. But now, what does it mean? Which kind of measure is a distribution of solution u evaluated at time t? So look, now since my force depends on a random parameter, then my solution depend on the random parameter as well. So I claim then distribution of my solution evaluated at time t is a nice measure mu in the phase space H. Which kind of measure is it? To define which kind of measure I have to explain how to integrate a function against this measure, and I have to explain how to measure measures of different sets using these measures. First, let me show you how to integrate functions against this measure. Let us take any bounded continuous function on my functional space. Then to integrate this function f against the measure mu 2, I have to do the following. I have to evaluate my solution at time t. I have to evaluate f of u of t. This is nice random variable. And then I have to calculate the mathematical expectation of this random variable. Yes. And this mathematical expectation corresponds to integrating against some measure, and this is the measure mu t. Another way to describe measure mu t, which is the definition of my random variable u of t, is the following. Let us take any set O in the space H. then the measure mu t of the space O can be is defined in the following way. Measure mu t of O is the probability that my solution evaluated at time t belongs to the space O. Yes, and so so what I need from the theory of probability are just absolutely basic knowledges, absolutely basic objects, and this is essentially what I need. So, but the notion of distribution of solution of my t, this is absolutely crucial for me. Let us consider two examples. These are examples how to integrate different random variables with respect to the measure mu t is above. Let us take any point x naught in the torus, and let us take the following function. Function f of u is u of x naught. So this is just delta function. Yes. So this is very nice. This is very nice function defined on the space of continuous vector field. That in this case, if I integrate function f against measure mu t, this is just nothing but at time t evaluate solution at point t x naught and to take mean value of this object. Then of course, since u is a vector, then the result is a vector in R2. The following result is the crucial for the whole theory of statistical hydrodynamics, and this is what is called correlation tensor. Let us take any two points, x1, x2, from the torus. Let us consider the following random variable, which is u of x1 times u of x2. Since u is a two vector, then in this case f of u is a 2x2 matrix. So now f of u is a function which maps space of continuous vector field in the space R4, also in the space of 2x2 matrices. And just in this case, if I integrate this function against the measure mu t, this is the same as I evaluate u of t x1 times u of t x2, and if I take mean value of this product. And this is called correlation tensor of solution, and this object, which is a function of time t and of space variable x1, x2, is the crucial for the whole theory of turbulence and is crucial for the whole of statistical hydrodynamics. If by some miracle we had a way just to learn everything about the correlation tensor, then the whole mystery of the theory of turbulence would be solved. Yes, so in fact, the only random variables which I have to learn how to integrate against my measure, this is exactly this random variable. But unfortunately, we cannot study these random variables and integrating of these random variables without developing much bigger machinery. This is as usual. So we have, yeah, Andrush. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, for both processes, no matter. Yes, the same. Notion is the same. So these are very, very general definitions. So my claim is the following. So in statistical hydrodynamics, what they care about only about the tensor. In these books on statistical hydrodynamics and just on the theory of turbulence, essentially what they do, they consider this tensor and they study its property. If by some miracle we knew everything about this tensor, then we knew everything about the theory of turbulence. So this is the most important example. But we cannot start this example without developing much bigger machinery. Okay. Now, once again, solution u of t is called stationary. If when I consider my solution at time t, and if I evaluate the distribution of my solution at time t, this is the measure mu sub index t in the space H, and solution is called stationary if the measure mu sub index t is independent of time t. First, existence of a stationary measure. Existence of a stationary measure, this follows from a very general principle, which is called Боголюбов-Крылов theorem. And the theorem roughly states that if we have some a priori estimate, not at all strong. Then the stationary measure exists. So and in all partial differential equations where we can do at least everything, we have some a priori estimate. Yes, and this a priori estimate which we have always sufficient to apply Bogoliubov-Krylov theorem. So in the group of problems which you consider, in the group of problems related to partial differential equations with random right-hand side, existence of a stationary measure is not a problem at all, because it follows from a very general, in fact, Bogoliubov-Krylov theorem follows from a very general ansatz, so this is a very general result. So what is really a challenge here? This is the uniqueness of a stationary measure. And uniqueness of a stationary measure, this is much more delicate subject. And this is the next topic of my talk. So here I shall explain the main result on uniqueness, and I shall try to explain why this is so important. Okay, theorem one is the following. So let us assume that our force, and this is, let us assume that our random force is such that the content, that the constant BF, which measures intensity of the noise in the free mode number S, that this coefficient, that the constant BS are non-zero for all S's which are no bigger than some constant n nu, n sub index nu, where this is a sufficiently large constant which goes to infinity when nu goes to zero. If so, then the following statements hold true. First, equation 1 prime, which is there on the blackboard, has a unique stationary measure mu. Second, this is maybe the most remarkable property. So this is what I have, this is the condition 2. Condition 2 is that intensity BS is non-zero for all S's which are no bigger than in nu. And then under this assumption, the following property 3 holds. So if I evaluate my solution at time t, and if I evaluate the distribution of my solution at time t, then this is a measure in the space H. Then this measure weakly converges to the stationary measure mu as t goes to infinity exponentially fast. So, and in fact, yes, and just another property c, which is sufficiently cheap consequence of the first two properties which are really deep and important properties. This is the statement that there exists stationary solution u of t such that distribution of this solution u of t is exactly my measure mu. Yeah. Yes, you're right, yes. Well, just okay. First, please know that I have no lower bound on the noise on the constant BS. So just physically, this is something natural. I just apply noise to my object, and I have some noise in every Fourier mode. Due to, for example, cosmic noise, atmosphere noise. No, noise is everywhere. Well, but yes. No, I don't. Okay, it's another story. So for the proof which we have now, this assumption is substantial. If we can prove theorem without this assumption now, the answer is yes, but not in so strong form. And this is something which is so this is really difficult problem. This is. Negative degree of nu. So just practically it means that just all BSs are non-zero. I have some noise in every Fourier mode. So this is general position assumption. I have something in each Fourier mode. Yes. No, this is not. Because this assumption doesn't exclude. For example, typical example when it holds that they have first four Fourier modes which just carry 99% of the energy of noise. And they have just some some tail noise in the higher Fourier amounts. So I repeat once again, I have no lower bound on NBS. If I had lower bound, then just indeed this just would be the case. But I have no lower bound. So 99% of the energy of the noise can be supported by the first four Fourier amounts. This is true, Walter. This is true. Well, just let me move from this point, because otherwise I can stuck here for the last 5 minutes of my lecture. So this is an issue. This is a problem. Actually, we can prove now. Now we can prove that for some classes of problems under consideration, four BS, four to non-zero BS, or maybe nine is sufficient. But this is not what I wish to discuss now. This is more difficult. Okay. Well, this theorem was first proved in my joint paper with my former postdoc Armen Shirikyan in the year 2000, and the proof was for the Kick-Frost equation, but for big variety of equation. In fact, lot of equation. In fact, the theorem which we proved applies to a lot of equations which can be written in this form, such that dynamics of this equation is well defined. So what we have here is a very general theorem for the case of kick forces. Well, just here it is written that just the main idea of the proof is to use Fourier-Schroder reduction to reduce one prime, which is an infinite dimensional dynamical system, to a finite dimensional dynamical system with delay, which is in fact a Gibbs system in the space of dimension n mu squared, where n mu is exactly this constant in dimension 2, in the assumption 2. And next, prove that the corresponding Gibbs that the corresponding Gibbs system has a unique Gibbs measure. And this reduction is as a tool to prove uniqueness, yes, is a discovery of this our work one. After this, in a similar way, the Navier-Stokes equation with the case of white forces E to of t was considered, and this was done also. This is a very well known reference now. This was done in the papers by Imatin Lisenai and the paper of Brickman, Kupianin, Lefebvre. Important remark is that, in fact, as I shall explain very soon, the main issue, physically the most important, is not that we have a unique stationary measure, but physically the most important is this convergence. And for the case of kick forces, this convergence was proven in our first paper, which is my first paper with Armen. But for white forces equation, the convergence theory was not proven here. It was done later, so there is quite a number of references here. So if somebody is interested, then this my review paper contains history of the object, of the subject. Why this is important? It is important because convergence theory is one of the basic postulates of statistical hydrodynamics. And this here comes rather extended quotation from the book of Batchelor. In this book of Batchelor, on this page, Batchelor view Navier-Stokes equation as an infinite dimensional dynamical system. And here he says the following. We put our faith in the tendency for dynamical system with a large number of degree of freedom and with coupling between this degree of freedom to approach a statistical state which is independent, partially or not wholly, on the initial condition. This is page 6 from the Batchelor book. And similar statements arrive at page 6, 10, or 15 on any book on the theory of turbulence. So this is really a postulate, which really postulate all books and all treatment of the theory of turbulence. 60s, there were a lot of editions, but it has not changed. It was the same. So, but just in some books it was written clearly that this is a postulate. In some books it was hidden that this is a postulate. But this fact that statistics of solution is independent of initial condition, this is a postulate of the theory of turbulence which was not proven before this our works. Okay, so now in fact I am almost short of time, so I shall make some kind of review of my last slides. Here, okay, stationary in time and in space solutions. In the theory of statistical hydrodynamics and the theory of turbulence, the most important are solutions which are stationary both in space and in time. Actually, this is what they usually study in the book on the theory of turbulence and in the book on statistical hydrodynamics. This solution U of Tx, which is in the theorem 1 and which corresponds to the stationary measure, is stationary in time t. And the question is, are the solutions stationary in the space x? Well, in fact, they are. So let us consider the following case. Let us consider White-Frost equation, and let us consider the case where the coefficient Bs, which corresponds to, let us assume that this our assumption 2 holds, and let us assume that in addition that the coefficient Bs equals to the coefficient B minus s. So it means that intensity of noise in front of sine x and in front of cosine x is the same. Then, since all my random variables are Gaussian, that it is easy to check, almost obvious, that the corresponding process zeta, and eta is the time derivative of zeta, is a process which is stationary in x. This elementary consequence of the Gaussian nature of the noise. Okay, so in this case, the force which I apply to my equation is stationary in space. And then the fact, and then the theorem that we have unique stationary measure easily implies that the corresponding solution U of Tx also is stationary in X. So in this case, this is cheap consequence from the uniqueness theorem. I have no time to explain why, but this is almost obvious. And correspondingly, our unique stationary measure, which is mu, is a measure which is stationary with respect to the translation of space variables. So here comes theorem 2. If assumption 2 and 2 prime holds, and assumption 2 prime is that Bs equals to B minus S, then the corresponding stationary solution U of Tx is stationary in T and X, and the stationary measure mu is stationary with respect to translations of X. In particular, the following happens. Now look, since mean value of our solutions equals to zero, this is my assumption, then the following simple calculation holds. Mean value of integral of dx equals to zero. Then by Fubini it means that integral of mathematical expectation equals to zero. Then, but since this is a stationary in x solution, it means that 2 pi squared, which is area of the top, times expectation of u equals to zero. Therefore, this our stationary solution is such that if I evaluate my solution at any point t and x, and if I evaluate mean value of the solution, then the result is zero, as it should be in the theory of turbulence, because turbulence motion, these are exactly motions where the mean value of velocity equals to zero, and only oscillation matters. And this relation will be used somewhat later, just in another 2 or 3 minutes. Actually, in this theorem, we proved more. And the lemmas which we used to prove the theorem and the theorem itself allow us to get quite a number of very useful results, which are also very important for the theory of turbulence. First of these results is the strong law of large numbers. Let us take any functional f, which is a Lipschitz functional defined on my space H script. Then let us take any initial condition u naught. And in this way, I shall define solution of my equation equal to u naught at t equal to zero. Then let us calculate time average of my solution. Then when time goes to zero, then the time average converges to ensemble average almost surely. And this is a corollary of theorem 1 and corollary of lemmas to prove this theorem. And again, in my review, there are more information on this result. And again, this is the strong law of large numbers. This is one of the results which are important for the theory of turbulence. And again, there is another quotation from the book of Batchelor that this is a result which is needed to develop the whole theory. And of course, it was postulated. It was not proven before. Another consequence which we can derive from our theorem, and also again from lemmas which we used to prove the theorem, it doesn't follow directly from the theorem, is the central limit theorem. And now the result is the following, and this is the last section of my talk. So let mu be a stationary measure, and let f be a functional on my phase space H, which is a Lipschitz function, such that mean value of my functional with respect to mesh vanishes. Let u of t be any solution of equation 1 prime, with just any with any initial data u naught. Then due to the theorem 1, mean value of f of u of t evaluated at time t minus 0, okay, exponentially fast converges to 0. That on the language of the theory of probability, it means that the process f u of t satisfies good mixing condition. Therefore, certain version of the central limit theorem, which is essentially due to Gordon publications from the year 69, applies, and therefore we have the following elegant result. That if I take any solution from a Navier-Stokes equation such that the average with respect to stationary measure equals to zero, then if I average my solution from zero to t, and if I scale it with the proper factor, that in distribution this object converges to a certain Gaussian measure with zero mean value. And again, this result is in my review paper. And again, this statement is of physical significance, because this was a statement which was very well known in physical literature, of course, without proof. And on physical language, this statement tells us that in large time scale, solutions of equation 1 prime have Gaussian statistic. And on large time scale means that exactly we make here this average from 0 to t. I guess I have another 2 minutes because I started slightly late. So actually, okay, I have two more slides, Walter, so. Okay, yes. Yes, so just let me, okay, so this, let me show, but why this is nice? Because in this way we can get something which really explains one of old paradoxes which are related to the numerics for the turbulent flow. And this paradox is the following. So let me show you, tell me about application of the central limit theorem. So in my usual frame, so let us consider the case when theorem 1 applies, and let us the case when bs equals to b minus s, so then my force is stationary in x, and then my stationary measure also is stationary in x. This is theorem 2. Then if, let us consider the function f of u, which evaluate our solution at some fixed point u x naught. Now f of u equals to u of x naught. Then, as I draw your attention before, the mean value of this functional against the measure mu vanishes. This was something like three or four slides before. Then the central limit theorem applies now, and we arrive at the following result, which is definitely physically important. So if I evaluate velocity field of my solution at any point x naught at time s, and if I average this velocity field in time, and if I scale it, then what I shall get in distribution is a Gaussian random variable. And this is, in fact, that explains some old and well-known paradox in hydrodynamics, which I found in the same book of Batchelor. So maybe this I like it that much. This paradox is the following. Let us consider a physical device, which is called anemometer. And anemometer, this is some mechanical device, for example, like this one, which measure velocity of air at a fixed point of space, at some point x naught. So x naught is the center of this physical device. Then, of course, it is obvious that what this device measures due to its physical nature is not the instant velocity u of zero x, not the velocity at time t, but some average velocity, right? So physical devices, they have inertia. So what they measure is not instant value of velocity, but some averaged value. So what they measure, in fact, due to central limit theorem, is an object which must have Gaussian statistic. And the picture below is taken from the book of Batchelor. So the correspondent experiments with mechanical devices, more sophisticated than this one, they were run systematically in Cambridge in late 40s by by the Townsend in collaboration with Batchelor. And the result of these experiments have shown that indeed that the evaluation gave a random variable such that distribution of this random variable is just amazingly close to the Gaussian distribution. When Batchelor in his book writes about these experiments, he is not comfortable because it is absolutely unnatural. It cannot be that solution of so strongly nonlinear equation as Navier-Stokes equation has Gaussian statistic. There are no physical reasons. But still highly reliable numerics, and Batchelor knew that the numerics that they highly reliable show that the distribution is Gaussian. Possible explanation is that due to inertia of their mechanical device, what they measured was not instant velocity of the fluid, but velocity of the fluid in sufficiently large time scale. So then central limit theorem applied, and what they saw in this numerics was not the distribution of the velocity field, but the central limit theorem, in action. And this is the end of my lecture, and thank you very much.